Hello, and welcome to Diabetes Dialogue, technology, therapeutics, and real-world perspectives. Diabetes Dialogue is a monthly podcast hosted by myself, Diana Isaacs, and Natalie Bellini, providing a regular news roundup of the latest clinically applicable insights across diabetes and metabolic diseases, with a focus on leveraging technology to improve care. Produced by HCP Live Endocrinology, the audio version of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, with a video version available only on hcplive.com.
Oh, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I am joined by the wonderful Natalie Bellini. And we have a, there we go, light. All right, we have a action-packed episode for you today where we're going to talk about a few different topics. There's been some new data for tirzepatide or Mounjaro. There also is some interesting data related to a new drug, verapamil, and protecting beta cell function for type 1 diabetes. And then lastly, there was a new device that was FDA approved last week called the Omnipod Go, offering another new novel way for insulin delivery. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Let's see. Maybe we'll start with tirzepatide first, if that is okay. So Mounjaro has been in the news a lot, as other drugs have been, for weight loss. I mean, we've heard a lot about Ozempic and Trulicity and the GLP-1 receptor agonists and everything. So Mounjaro is that dual GLP-1/GIP receptor agonist. So it does have a little bit of more of a novel mechanism. So we've been using it for type 2 diabetes based on the SURPASS trials. And then earlier this year, we had the SURMOUNT, or I guess it was last year, we had the SURMOUNT-1 study that was done in people without diabetes. So it was used specifically for weight management. And that study showed up to almost 21% weight loss in the largest dose, which is 15 milligrams. So there's actually, that was one study, but there's a whole SURMOUNT clinical program to study in different populations for weight management. So hot off the press, we have the top line results for SURMOUNT-2. And this study was done in people with type 2 diabetes, but designed for weight, basically for weight loss. And so 938 adult participants with type 2 diabetes and obesity took 15 milligrams of tirzepatide or the 10 or versus placebo over 72 weeks they were followed for. And so those taking the highest dose, the 15 milligrams, had on average 15.7% body weight reduction. So that was losing up to 34.4 pounds. And then those on the 10 milligram dose lost up to 13.4% or almost 30 pounds. And then we always do placebo controlled, because if the placebo group loses tons of weight, then we know it wasn't the drug, right? So in the placebo group, they lost on average only 3.3% or 7 pounds over the 72 weeks. So Natalie, what do you think about these results?
You know, we know that with weight loss without diabetes, the weight loss drugs seem to have a more profound effect, right? So in SURMOUNT-1, there was more weight loss in people without diabetes that were looking for weight loss alone. People with diabetes have lots of other things going on, right? So, but these results are phenomenal. This is, I mean, 15.7% body weight loss. I love the idea that, you know, this is okay, the mean percentage is 15, which means there's more, people lost more than that, people lost less than that, right? So you have to remember that that's the mean. But the percentage of people achieving greater than 5%, which is this baseline weight loss that we look towards, on the 15 milligrams was 86%. And that is profound, right? That is where we say, wow, this is really making a difference. On the 10 milligram, it was 82%, right? That's a lot. The other thing I loved was that then we look at the other end, right? What percent of people lost more than 15%, right? Or greater than or equal to 50% of the people on the 15 milligram dose, it's actually 52%, lost greater than 15% body weight at 72 weeks. So this is a really long study, right? It's looking at weight loss over time. And this is a big deal. We're excited about this.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I mean, I know a lot of times with type 2 diabetes, we do see less weight loss compared to people that are taking it without diabetes. And, you know, some of it can be the other medications that they're taking. We know meds like sulfonylureas, insulin, can cause weight gain, or others like TZDs. And so that's an extra barrier sometimes people with diabetes have. And one of the reasons why sometimes there's not as much weight loss in the trials compared to those without diabetes. But still, I mean, very, very impressive. And to sustain that over this period of time, I mean, when I compare it to like other drugs, like phentermine, for example, I mean, a lot of times those are studied just over 12 weeks, just 3 months. And so to show this type of sustained weight loss over 72 weeks is definitely, it's so great. So I'm kind of curious. I mean, we're using a lot of Mounjaro in clinical practice. At this time, it's just had the FDA approval for type 2 diabetes, but kind of curious what's been your experience with patients using this drug so far.
Oh, people love it, right? I mean, I think that they like that the pen is easy to use, right? We as clinicians love to see the results. I think we need to go backwards a little bit and talk about the side effect profile, right? You know, when we talk about side effects and we look at studies, if a person has one issue the entire time the study happens, that is a reported issue, right? And they're counted in the numbers. So nausea was the biggest side effect, or one of them, right? And that was about slightly over 20% in both the 10 and 15 milligram. I love that the placebo was 6.3% of patients, right? Also had nausea, and they weren't getting the drug. So you are going to have some patients that have, and diarrhea was up there at almost 20% in the 10 milligram and slightly over in the 15 milligram. So we need to look at that and say, you know, we can look at this two different ways. 80% of the people had no problems at all with nausea or diarrhea, right? And I think that sometimes when we present the, okay, there's the side effects and you have to be careful, and that, you know, the majority of patients don't have problems with it. We do have people that can't tolerate it, right? Because their side effect is too strong. We have that with metformin, right? So I think that what we're looking for is another answer, which is what this is, with profound weight loss, which is what this is. And if there's a side effect issue, we're just going to go back and look for another medication. I think that we shouldn't say, no, that's too much. It's not, right? Because of the data around it. You know, we're seeing amazing A1C reductions as well as weight loss.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. And there's always side effects with any medication. So there's always there's some people that don't tolerate it. The other thing I do like in practice is, so we have the starting dose of 2.5 milligrams. And it's true, there is a fairly long titration schedule because you start at 2.5 and then 5. 5 is a therapeutic dose. So for some people, if they are experiencing a lot of side effects, I'll leave them at 5, or we'll do 5 for a bit longer and gradually go up. And we increase by 2.5 milligrams at a time. So that really allows the body to get used to it. Where I see problems sometimes is when people are switching from a GLP-1 agonist, like let's say going from Victoza or Ozempic or Trulicity and switching to Mounjaro and not starting with the lower doses, kind of going straight to a higher dose, like 7.5 or 10 milligrams. And that's when I often see more side effects, because keep in mind, like it's a GLP-1 agonist, but it's also a GIP agonist. And so that potentially can produce different side effects or just different impact on the body. So that's been, by starting with the lower doses, I found that to be really helpful.
I agree with you. I think that, you know, people want to jump from one to the other. And we need to not do that. We need to start at the beginning and say, you know, we're going to go on our terms with this and go up slowly as tolerated. And again, if we're seeing results that we want at the lower dose, leave them there. You don't have to push and push and push this medication. You've got lots of room to go up. And when I explain that to the person with diabetes sitting in front of me, I think that just Everything gets like, you know, I got to get to 15. No, you don't, right? Look at what 10 does. Look at what, you know, and I think that there is a dose titration that's recommended in the, you know, but that's not what we have to do, right? So we do it on our terms. And a lot of times I'll say, let's just leave you here for 8 whole weeks and see where we get to, or even 12 weeks, and then decide to go up if we need to. Let's get another A1C. Let's see how you feel. But again, most people tolerate it very, very well. And I think that as clinicians, we need to remember that part of it.
Yeah, definitely. And the other interesting thing is that the SURMOUNT program, it's going to be looking at a few different studies, and hopefully all of this will support for the FDA decision to ultimately approve it for weight management, irrespective of diabetes. But recently we heard SURMOUNT 5 is actually going to be tirzepatide versus semaglutide, actually the Wegovy version of semaglutide, which is the version used for weight management at the 2.4 milligram dose. So this is really interesting because there was a SURPASS study for type 2 diabetes that compared semaglutide versus tirzepatide. But one of the limitations to that study was the semaglutide dose was limited to 1 milligram because that's what was available at this time. So now they're going to be going head to head, the 15 milligrams of tirzepatide versus the 2.4 of semaglutide. And I feel like that's pretty brave. Because, I mean, Wegovy is pretty potent. It's also a great option for weight loss. So, I don't know. I'm really excited to see what the results of that trial ultimately show.
I agree. I think it's going to be very exciting. And I love the fact that Lilly is willing to do this, right? They want to look at this head-to-head. You know, we're always talking about, well, you can't compare one trial to the next because there's different patients and different, you know, different comparators. And, you know, you can't do that. And this is saying, okay, we're going to do it because we're going to do the trial and do it correctly. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, definitely. So, and then there's going to be more trials too, looking at the cardiovascular outcomes, which ultimately are really going to be needed to, you know, I think that info would be really helpful to convince more payers that this is really worthwhile to be covering these drugs, since they do have, you know, a higher price tag on them. So I want to switch gears a little bit and next talk about verapamil. So verapamil has recently been reported out. We heard results at ATTD, and based on the CLEVER trial with Greg Forlenza and colleagues. And Natalie, can you tell us a little bit about what we've seen with verapamil for type 1 diabetes?
Yes, it's an interesting, right? It's an interesting thing, right? So there's a couple of different trials that have been done now using verapamil. Verapamil is a calcium channel blocker, and the latest trial called the CLEVER trial was using extended release verapamil in newly diagnosed children with type 1 diabetes. So the results were that C-peptide levels in the verapamil-treated group were 30% higher compared to placebo at 52 weeks. And the preservation of C-peptide levels in the verapamil group demonstrates that intervention preserved that beta cell function, right? So C-peptide, when I explain it to a person with diabetes, I say, you know, when you run your car and it produces carbon monoxide, when your body makes insulin, it produces this side effect that is C-peptide, and we can measure that. And no matter how much insulin you inject, it doesn't change your C-peptide. That's produced in your body, right? We can tell the difference. So they gave these newly diagnosed people verapamil, extended-release verapamil, and it preserved their beta cell function. The beautiful thing about this is that verapamil has been around for years and years and years, and it's about $8 to $12 from GoodRx. So this is something we could consider using in newly diagnosed people, right? What are the concerns? The concerns are this is the first real randomized control trial, and we need more data, right? So Diana, are you saw this come out. You've read the data. Have you used it yet in a newly diagnosed patient just to see what, or help? What are your thoughts on that?
So I'm mind blown because this is like, this is such an old drug that we've had for a while that we use to treat hypertension. And so it's kind of amazing that this drug is serving another function. I haven't used it yet. I mean, I do work with adults primarily. So, but I'm in thinking about it, and like that adult with LADA, the Latin autoimmune diabetes of adults, who still has beta cell function and we're often using other therapies like GLP-1 agonists, I think verapamil could be a great option, especially if they also have hypertension. It's so interesting because in the trial with the kids, I mean, most of them didn't have hypertension, but were still able to tolerate this drug very well. And to see that kind of preservation in beta cell function, I mean, that's a big deal because that means less likelihood of DKA, often easier to manage diabetes, less variability, better quality of life during that time. And I mean, looking at it for a year, I mean, we don't even know. It'd be interesting to see like what happens 3 years out, 5 years out. And so I am very, very intrigued. Definitely, if I had someone with hypertension and newer onset, I'd be very inclined to use it. And probably discussion, you know, pros, you know, risks versus benefits. I have to say I'm very, very intrigued. How about you?
So the other day I had a 25-year-old newly diagnosed, brand new, and we discussed it. We talked about it for a long time, and he chose to start it. So the hard part is, because it's a study of one, right? How do I know if his C-peptide level is preserved because of the verapamil or not? We will never know, but we're going to measure it every 6 months and see where we get to. We also started him on a automated insulin delivery system. So it'll be interesting to see what we get, but I feel like the data is strong enough that because the safety profile of verapamil has been, you know, it's a drug that's years and years and years in use, that I don't, we're not, we, there are very, the side effect profile is low enough that it was worth trying. And he was absolutely on board with it.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. Yeah, you'll have to let us know how that goes. But yeah, and when I think about this, because there was also that trial that looked at people with new onset type 1 diabetes starting automated insulin delivery right away versus placebo to see if maybe starting on that therapy right away would preserve their beta cell function. And unfortunately, it didn't show a difference.
Right, right. So maybe this with verapamil, maybe that will, right? Yep, exactly.
Right. But I love how you empowered the person with diabetes to basically decide. And I think that's awesome. And so, yeah, it'll be kind of interesting to see what happens. I mean, this is a generic drug. So I don't know that I don't know what's going to happen. Like if anyone would try to brand this and pursue an FDA indication based on this. So it might be up to us to decide, you know, in clinical practice, kind of what we want to do, at least for now, when there's not like a specifically branded drug with a branded indication.
Right. And what that means is, you know, if there's no indication for it, but it is used to treat hypertension. So I prescribed it when I prescribed it the other day, we had no issues. Right. I think that when you send a generic drug through, there's less flack from the insurance company. Right. There's no step edit to get to verapamil. Right. So it's not like they say they have to have lisinopril first. Right. And that's an amazing thing because we can use it as we want to. And I think that will help. Again, I agree with you, though. This was a study because JDRF funded it, right? And JDRF's goals are not just to cure diabetes, but to treat it now. And what if we could combine that verapamil with teplizumab, right? What if we could? And I think we're going to look at other studies in the future that say, okay, you're newly diagnosed. We know where your beta cell function is going. Can we slow that down for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? What are we getting, right? So we know that Tzield delays onset of type 1 the full phase 3, you know, stage 3 type 1 diabetes. Could we add verapamil to the Tzield and preserve it even longer? And we don't know the answers to that yet, but that's where I see it going is, can we add it to other therapies that we know do slow things down?
Right. And well, I mean, it'll be interesting because teplizumab is being studied in the PROTECT trial.
Right.
And so it'll kind of be interesting to see how that drug does with the C-peptide preservation and how that compares to verapamil. I would expect it to be more, but also teplizumab costs a lot more. So it'll kind of be interesting. And to your point, would it be possible to combine the two? From a side effect profile and drug interaction profile, I wouldn't see an issue with it. So it'll be kind of interesting how all that plays out.
But new and exciting, and really, this is really the first discussion, 2023 really is you and I having that discussion of how do we slow things down? We've never talked about this before because there wasn't anything.
Right. Yeah. And I'm also just thinking to your point how, the insurance companies aren't going to stop us from prescribing verapamil because it's such a low cost drug. So it's just interesting because it's like when you try to use other drugs like GLP-1 agonists off label for weight, which we know it's super effective for, it's like you can't get it because insurance will just block it completely. All right, cool. Well, the last topic we want to talk about was a new FDA approval that just came out. That was kind of a surprise for me because I didn't even have this on my radar. And that is something called the Omnipod Go. So it would be a new device so for those not as familiar, so Omnipod has pumps, the Omnipod Dash, and then also more recently, the Omnipod 5, which is an automated insulin delivery system. So the idea of the Omnipod Go is it's really simple. It's not like the Dash or the 5 where it's like got the smart technology and the bolus calculator and the 5 where it's integrated with CGM. This is designed to be a very simple device that basically gives a consistent basal rate in the background. And so it's designed for people with type 2 diabetes that require a long acting or a basal insulin that are not on mealtime insulin at this time. And you have your choice. It sounds like there's going to be rates to choose from anywhere from 10 units a day up to 40 units per day. And this would be designed to last for 72 hours, similar to what we have with the Dash and the Omnipod 5. So curious, Natalie, kind of initial thoughts on this new insulin delivery option.
So I think people with diabetes sometimes struggle taking basal insulin, right? And so when you and I see them in our offices, we say things like, how many days are you getting basal? You can look at their data and know that sometimes they're missing or whatever. And I think this may help if you fill the pod once every 3 days, put it on your body and you're getting that delivery, right? So I like that idea of it. I think that, the majority of people with type 2 diabetes don't need mealtime insulin, right? And this is an answer to that. I think that it's going to be interesting to see where this falls into our treatment algorithms, right? And you and I in our heads kind of go, okay, first we do this and then we do this. And how do we, and then there's obviously people who we treat differently than that in our heads, but that's kind of what we do. Where does this fall? I think someone who has a variety of scheduling conflicts, right? Some nights I'm out, some nights I'm not. I struggle to take my insulin at night. Let's try it in the morning. That's not working well either. This could be an answer to that, right? I wish that there was more than 40 units in it. I wish there was more of a max than 40. But again, I think that there's going to be a role in it because when the insulin is delivered consistently, like it is with a basal pump, you tend to need less insulin than you do with injectable basal insulin.
Well, that's a good point, right? And I think because it's going to have a rapid acting insulin in it instead of like a long acting insulin. So the idea being, and we've seen this with other studies like with Vigo, that often a lower dose is required. So even though it only holds up to 40 units, it would be kind of a more, it's going to work more efficiently. So that's equivalent to in long acting, maybe 50 units. So I agree with you. It's still, we also wish it was a larger dose because I've got patients that are on much larger doses, and that's why we have things like the Traceba and the Toujeo Max and stuff that can go up to 160 units per pen injection because people are requiring that much. But I do like the idea that hopefully it'll be more efficient insulin delivery in one injection every 3 days, or really one insertion every 3 days instead of daily. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of people that are on like a twice daily long acting insulin, which I try to convert them to once daily. I think it's just interesting because there's more competition in this space now. So like, for example, we have the Vigo, and Vigo is kind of making a comeback since MannKind purchased them. And so Vigo is a 24-hour device, but it all has the two-unit boluses. So for those that do need the boluses, you can do up to 36 units per day is available in bolus, and their highest rate, it comes in 20, 30, 40. So you can go up to 40, similar to this. And then we also have the Secure Simplicity, which is
right.
It's different in that it's not a basal. It's just designed for mealtime. So now we kind of have these three options, which it's just kind of mind-blowing, because a few years ago, I guess we had Vigo. We didn't have Secure Simplicity, and that was all that we kind of had in this space. But as I'm thinking about it, I mean, we know weekly insulin is also on the horizon, which will be very, very different. But if someone only had to give one injection a week, what would be preferable, like the one injection a week or wearing a patch and changing it every 3 days? I mean, I don't know. I love choices, so I'm definitely a fan of choices. But to your point, like, where is this going to fall in? And with all of these choices, like, how is the healthcare team going to decide? And with the person with diabetes, like, how are we going to keep all of this straight and kind of help guide the person to the best option?
Right. And I think that, like you said, options are the you know, sometimes I'll be talking to someone and they'll choose something like, we can do this and we can do this. And, you know, it's just different ways to get there, because diabetes isn't a one size fits all. And they'll choose something. And I'm even surprised that that's the route they go. Right. So I think that we just have to, as clinicians, always, always, always offer everything that is available and let the person with diabetes make that final decision. We don't know their lives. We don't know what they do every day. We try to get a glimpse of it when we talk to them. But the idea that we understand what they're going through is truly false, right? We don't know. So I think that this is another tool in the box to open up and say, here we go. We could do it this way. You're struggling getting daily insulin in. Let's try it this way. Let's see what happens. Because it's going to be a pharmacy benefit. If the person with diabetes tries it and doesn't like it, there's no real, you know, it's not that I bought a durable medical equipment insulin pump. I did, you know, this is just, you know, you got 30 days at a pharmacy or 90 days. Let's see if this works better for you. And I like that as an option. I would love, love, love to see a basal pump titrate with a continuous glucose sensor, right? I could love to see that basal going up and down based on the glucose sensor in the future. That would be my, if we look at what would we, you know, even if it never boluses, if it would just titrate basal, I would love that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because I could see, going back to the choice thing, I could see how some people would be maybe weary, nervous about a weekly insulin, because it's like you take it, that whole dose is in you for the whole week, versus a patch. At any time, like, you can just take it off. And the fact that, it's available at the pharmacy, there's not really a commitment type thing. Going back to your comment about the CGM integration, like, I can't help but think, gosh, I wish this would integrate with CGM to automate the background insulin. And when it first came out, I thought, oh, is that what this is going to do? Because especially with, like, the Medicare approval of CGM for those on basal insulin, like, they'll likely all be able to use CGM, at least the Medicare, and hopefully commercial will follow that. So it's like, how cool would that be if you just had a simple patch, you didn't even have to bolus, and it was just kind of increasing or decreasing in the background. So hopefully that might be one of the next upcoming things on the horizon. But I think the key here is just designed to be simple. And some people want it to keep it kind of just simple. And so in the end of the day, it's good to have choices and different options for different.
I agree wholeheartedly. I think that I can't wait for it to be available and put it on some people and see where, you know, again, we have to get this basal insulin into you. These are our options. Tell me what interests you the most. What would you like to try first? Right. That is really the discussion that we should be having, because we don't know we don't know your life outside of here well enough to make that decision for you.
Right. And I mean, you and I both use pumps a lot in people with type 2 diabetes. I think the idea here is there's a lot of a lot of people are like weary. They're like, oh, pumps are meant for people with type 1 diabetes or the serious kind of diabetes. And I think the idea here is introduce this idea of wearing a pump earlier on in the diabetes journey. And then when maybe a person then does get to a point where they are needing mealtime insulin to maintain their glucose levels, that the idea of going to a pump would not be this big scary thing because they've already worn something on their body and likely it to be the same size. And so I think that's kind of some of the idea here of introducing it a little earlier on.
And I also think that if we go back to the SURMOUNT data, right, and look at that, you know, significant A1C reduction, significant, you know, weight loss, lots of people need a little bit of basal and a GLP-1 or a GIP-GLP-1, right? And this is that answer, right? You need a little bit of background, but that GLP-GIP combination or just GLP-1 makes the body make insulin when those blood sugars start to rise at meals, and the person with diabetes only needs basal, right, for a very, very long time. I think that this is a great option for that too.
For sure. Well, thanks so much for the great chat. Thank you everyone for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, and we will catch you next time.